Hello again, everybody. This is Joseph Patridge, the director of the Wirth Institute for Austrian and Central European Studies, and I'm happy to welcome you to the latest podcast in our series Exploring Central European History. Today, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Vienna World's Fair of 1873, the first World's Fair that wasn't held either in London or Paris. But before we climb aboard the horse-drawn streetcar and go clattering out down the tracks for about a mile and a half to the fairgrounds outside of Vienna, I wanted to remind you that if you're interested in some of the themes associated with the various presentations I've been making, please go to the website of the Wirth Institute, where you'll see various links, images, some more information. We have bibliographic references. We have links to websites that may be of interest. I would particularly underline the importance or the benefit of going to see the website, which is called The World of the Habsburger, right? The World of the Habsburgs. That is one that has all kinds of useful information, which might be helpful as I talk. If you're interested in seeing the maps, for example, of where the Habsburgs' holdings are, where I'm talking about, that's at www.habsburger.net. For today's presentation, it may be particularly useful to go see the map of what the Habsburgs' holdings look like after the Congress of Vienna. We're going to be jumping ahead a little bit in the chronology from last time. If you remember, last time I took the discussion up till the end of the Holy Roman Empire and the last Holy Roman Empress. So we got up to the early 19th century. Today we'll jump ahead to 1873. So you should look to see how things have changed as the empire was switched from the Holy Roman Empire to the Austrian Empire for a while. And then today I'll talk about the phase when it's the Austro-Hungarian Empire for the last 50 years or so of Habsburg rule. They ruled over a complicated conglomerate empire in Central Europe known as the Austro-Hungarian Empire. If you go to the website from last week and connect up to what I talked about last week, you'll see also that we have links to a few books. For example, I recommend the book about the Queen Regent Mariana of Spain. She's one of these Habsburgs who marry out and go away and then rule in abroad for a while. She was the Queen Regent of Spain in the late 17th century. And there's a recent work by Sylvia Mitchell dealing with her that we reference on the website of the Wirth Institute. Okay, well, let's now turn to 1873 and the Vienna World's Fair. I recently gave a presentation in an art history seminar led by Professor Elizabeth Boone on this topic. I talked about the World's Fair of 1873, and her class was about World's Fairs more generally. So this week we'll have some links on the website to information about the World's Fairs in general, which have become an area of a lot of research. A lot of people lately have been interested in studying these World's Fairs, which began in London in 1851 and continue to today, right? There's still World's Fairs. I went to one. I went to the relatively unsuccessful one in Germany in Hanover, but they continue. There's still World's Fairs, and we'll link you up with some information at the website. Also from the university catalog, library catalog here at the University of Alberta, we have access to a database about World's Fairs. You can look up information about the World's Fair of 1873 and others. I base my presentation today a bit on my experience going to an exhibition about the 1873 World's Fair, which I saw in Vienna in 2014. The Vienna Museum, the City Museum of Vienna, which is right now closed for renovation. And actually, by the way, while they're renovating it, they're finding some interesting stuff. They're digging around in the area around the museum and finding some interesting archaeological evidence, which helps us understand better the history of Vienna. Vienna's history, especially its early history, is always being rediscovered every time a parking garage is built or every time a subway is extended. And even in the reorganization and rehabilitation of the Vienna Museum, they're finding some interesting evidence in the area around that museum. But in 2014, they had a major exhibition dedicated to the World's Fair of 1873, and they produced a giant catalog. And we'll link at the website to the Vienna Museum and to the Vienna Museum's archive of earlier exhibitions, so you can go and see some images from this exhibition, especially some of the great black and white photography showing the exhibition and its preparation. That catalog, though, unfortunately, I don't think is available in English. I think it's only in German. It's called Experiment Metropole. So you can always get a look at the copy of it, which we have in the library here. Even if you can't read the German, you can at least look at the pictures. It's very well illustrated. It's a giant thing, and I thought the exhibition was very well done. Professor Boone in the art history program here recently published a book, which I think also we'll put a link to or a reference to on the website, dealing with world's fairs. It's called The Spanish Element in Our Nationality. And I'm particularly interested in referring to it here, not only because of referencing the work of a colleague here at the University of Alberta, but also because one of the exhibitions she discusses is the one that took place 15 years after the one I'll be talking about, the Great International Exposition in Barcelona in Spain in 1888. And by the way, this is an interesting exhibition, and Professor Boone talks about this a bit in her book because of the role that one of these Habsburg archduchesses who married into the royal family of Spain played. Actually, for something like 17 years in the late 19th century, Spain was ruled by a Habsburg archduchess who had been born in Brno, in what's now Czech Republic, in the Habsburg holdings in Central Europe. So like Queen Regent Mariana, who I mentioned a minute ago, who ruled Spain in the late 17th century, who had been born in Wiener Neustadt, which is now in Austria. Queen Maria Cristina was the regent of Spain in the late 19th century, ruling in the name of her son, Alfonso XIII. Alfonso XIII was only 2 years old when the World Exhibition opened in Barcelona in 1888. And Queen Maria Cristina from Brno played a major role in helping Spain through a very difficult time in its history. You may know that Spain in the late 19th century was really getting beaten up, losing control of a lot of its empire, she had to deal with things like revolts in the Philippines, revolts in Cuba, attacks by the Americans, right? The American Navy attacks the Spanish Navy in the Philippines, invades Cuba. Very difficult time to be the Queen Regent, I would say. But this is one of the last Habsburg women who moved away from the house and became important political figures abroad, the Queen Regent of Spain, Maria Cristina, who opened the World's Fair in Barcelona in 1888 in the name of her two-year-old son, Alfonso. But let's think a little bit about what was going on in Central Europe a few decades before 1888, and that is in 1873 and the years preceding. The Vienna World's Fair opened officially on May 1st, 1873, and I see it as part of an attempt by the Habsburgs to kind of remarket or rebrand themselves after a very difficult mid-19th century. already by the time the 19th century started and by the time the Revolutionary Wars and Napoleonic period is over, period of the Congress of Vienna of 1815, the Habsburgs' empire had shrunk dramatically from how large it was in the period I was talking about in my earlier podcasts, especially in the one about the marriage diplomacy, the podcast about marriage diplomacy, but also in the podcast about the Little Ice Age. That was the great age of the Habsburgs, right? The 16th and 17th century. By the 18th century, they're gaining some territories. They're adding some territories in what's now Western Ukraine. They get control of a section of the Wittelsbach territories of Bavaria. They get control of the part of the Prince Bishopric of Salzburg, which they kind of split with Bavaria. That's when the Habsburgs get Salzburg. I'll talk more about Salzburg next week. I talked a little bit about the wood in Salzburg last time, but when I talk about the von Trapp family and the Sound of Music, I have to talk about Salzburg, obviously. And that's acquired by the Habsburgs in the early 19th century. Also, maybe importantly, they get control of more of the Adriatic coast, taking over a lot of the old Venetian territories along the Dalmatian coast, Dalmatian area, and Istria. So they become an important naval power, but they've lost all of their overseas possessions by this point. Maybe next week I'll talk a little bit about how they get control of a small section of China in the early 20th century, but I won't talk too much about their overseas possessions. They're not really an imperial power, colonial power, in the same way, say, the French or the British were. They are much more a European power, a domestic European power, a continental European power, the Habsburgs by this point. Also, in the course of the mid-19th century, they lose control of Venice and Lombardy, some of the territories they had acquired briefly. Most of Italy now, a large portion of what's now Italy, is lost. And that's one of the big rivals which is going to develop in the course of the late 19th into the 20th century. That's the Kingdom of Italy. The new Kingdom of Italy was established in 1861. So we have a rival now in that part of the world that used to be more or less the Habsburgs' area of influence, sphere of influence. By the way, the unifying king of Italy, Victor Emmanuel, was a son of a Habsburg, so that goes back to some of my themes last time, and married a Habsburg. So the Habsburgs are all over the place, and it's sometimes hard to see them because of the marriage situation. But often, you know, if you look closely at the royalty and the royalty of Europe, you'll find Habsburg women. Okay, so we have the unification of Italy. Actually, the Habsburgs had been tied very closely to the Roman Catholic Church for a long time. That's really under a threat or challenge. Remember, the Italian kingdom attacks the papacy and captures the city of Rome in 1870. So there's a challenge to the authority of the Roman Catholic Church, which had been tied very closely to the Habsburgs. And probably the other major political development that I would like to briefly mention here is that the Habsburgs were increasingly having difficulty connecting up with but their rival in the Holy Roman, or in what became Germany. There's a new power on the world stage. Starting in early 1871, the Germans unify many of the political units of the old Holy Roman Empire, which of course had been abolished in 1806, but sets up this first empire, the second empire, the German Empire, in 1871. This is partly the result of defeating the Austro-Hungarians in battle in 1866, which had led to the Habsburgs having to kind of pull out or reduce their role in Germany due to the development of this new militant, unified German Empire, which again had been established in 1871 after the German army defeated the German state's army, defeated the French Empire, and leading to the establishment of the Third French Republic in 1870. So we have now a rival Kingdom of Italy in the south and a rival Empire of Germany in the north, which has pushed the Habsburgs a little bit out of the main, the center of affairs in Europe. These two rivalries will be complicated in the late 19th and 20th centuries, as I'll talk about in the future, I think. For our purposes today, I think we have to remember now that the Habsburgs have to redefine themselves. They have to as I said earlier, brand themselves. There had already been negotiations going on with the representatives of the Hungarian kingdom, which led to what is known as the Compromise of 1867 or the Ausgleich of 1867. Just like in Canada, the Confederation begins that year. In Austria-Hungary, we have the start of the new empire with a much more decentralized system of rule, giving a lot of authority over to the Hungarians are kind of splitting things, and that's why for the last 50 years or so of Habsburg rule in Europe, that their political unit is usually referred to in English as the Austro-Hungarian Empire, with two pretty distinct sections, an Austrian section ruled from Vienna and a Hungarian section ruled from the newly unified city of Budapest, where they take to some of the medieval and modern cities along the Danube and combine them into this giant conglomerate city, one of the biggest and more interesting and growing cities in Europe at the time, in the late 19th, early 20th century, the great city of Budapest. The Habsburgs then have to think of themselves no longer as the military ruler. They've lost territories to the Italians. They've lost role to the Germans. And I think the World's Fair of 1873 has to be seen kind of in the context of that loss of role and the redefinition of what it means to be a Habsburg, what it means to rule. What is it? Well, now they're going to see themselves more as kind of, I would say, more cultural, scientific, progress. And what's a better way to show the world how how progressive you are, how modern you are, but to host one of these giant world's fairs and kind of show off to the world that you are up to date and you are the cutting edge, right, in technology and science of the late 19th century. And that's where we put the World's Fair of 1873 into that context. The World's Fair itself also was put on in a very dynamic location, that is the city of Vienna itself. When you think of this World's Fair, you have to think of a city which is being rebuilt. One of the things which is being done is they're tearing down the old early modern walls of the city, which had been built up to defend against the Ottomans. The Ottomans had besieged the city of Vienna twice, once in the early 16th century and once the late 17th century. But after the successful relief of the siege in 1683, the need for these border fortifications, the walls around the city, was less and less. And even particularly after the end of the Napoleonic Wars, it didn't really seem like they needed all of these massive fortifications around the city. So one of the stories, the late 19th century, leading up to the World's Fair of 1873, is the reorganization of Vienna. Various things happen. They tear down the old walls following an imperial decree of 1857. Those walls are all gone by 1874. They build the elaborate Ringstrasse around the city, a kind of a hallmark of modernity with street lights and plumbing, water, sanitation, all of these things, streetcars, transportation. That opens officially on May Day of 1865. So 12 years to the day before the opening of the World's Fair, we have the Ringstrasse beginning to be opened. The regulation of the Danube River at Vienna, was a real mess. It broke into so many different branches. It was one of the reasons you could build the city there, because there were so many branches you could get across. It was also a good place to defend, a place you needed to defend, where the Vienna River meets the Danube River. Back in Roman times, the Romans had used this elevation at the this confluence as a defensive site. And it's partly because of the difficulty attackers would have of crossing the river at that point. But it also, on the other hand, was a place where the river could be crossed with bridges or ferries or so. But here, and the problem was it flooded a lot. And so starting in 1870 and ending in 1875, there was the regulation of the Danube. As the city grew, too, it really was expanding dramatically over the course of the 19th century. The city of Vienna needed water. So another thing that was happening in the city at this time was, starting in 1870, the development or the building of this massive 95-kilometer-long aqueduct to bring water from the mountains to the city, fresh water supplies. That would be actually opened during the World's Fair in October of 1873, just a few weeks before it officially closes, the fair officially closed, the city of Vienna with the Emperor Franz Joseph celebrated the opening of the water. It wasn't totally finished, I think, but there was the symbolic opening of the water supply system. So new streets, new communications, regulation of the Danube to stop the flooding, new water supply, all of this stuff showing that Vienna was really a modern city, a growing city, a thing that showed that the Habsburgs weren't out of the question. They were, just because they had been defeated by the Italians, just because they had been defeated by the Prussians, the idea was that they still were leaders in certain areas. That also, in this context, I probably should point out that they were organizing scientific expeditions. Of course, this is the great age of what people sometimes know as, you know, exploration of the world, where Europeans are going around. Hungarian noblemen and some other noblemen, with the support of the emperor, the Habsburgs, had financed a steamship, the Tegetthoff, to leave and go up to see if they could find the North Pole or go up into the northern regions, explorations. And from 1872 to 74, this ship, largely crewed by Croatian sailors, was up in the Arctic, going around finding, for example, or naming the Franz Josef Archipelago up there, naming it after the emperor of the Habsburgs empire, again showing how the Habsburgs were kind of cutting edge with science and all. On the other hand, I don't want to overemphasize the science, because I should say, too, that even though the papacy is having trouble with losing control of Rome and all, the Habsburgs still want to play that pious card, and they still want to be shown as religious. So even as the World's Fair is being established or set up or planned, they are also having connections to the Holy Land. Franz Josef, the emperor king, goes to Jerusalem in 1869, and he is considered the first Christian monarch to go to the Holy City since the Crusades. So there's a certain amount of, and he does it peacefully, right? That the Habsburgs now are rebranding themselves, coming out as the scientific, modern, but also religious, pious, peaceful Habsburgs, different than the Habsburgs perhaps had shown themselves in some ways before. So let's turn now to the World's Fair itself. The World's Fair, as I said, opened on May 1st, but of 1873. But it was after a long period of preparation. Right. This World's Fair was going to be the best ever. They wanted to show that they were similar to the French or to the British. They could do something. And so on about 230 hectares out in a parkland across the Danube River, the so-called Prater Park land, still a popular part of Vienna, they establish this giant World's Fair. Probably the most famous things there were the giant galleries, 190 meter long galleries, and the symbol of this World's Fair, and we have a picture of it on the advertisement for this podcast, was the giant rotunda with a replica of the Austrian imperial crown on top, this giant rotunda in which the opening ceremony was held on May 1st. This was a rotunda 108 meters in diameter, 84 meters tall. This was the centerpiece of the exhibition. It lasted, actually, I think, up until early 20th century, mid 20th century, when it fell victim to a fire. But this was a giant engineering feat, as I said, 108 meters in diameter, considered at the time to be the largest dome in the world, showing how the Habsburgs had the advantage of technology. It used 4,000 tons of iron and was over 2.2 times larger than the dome of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. It had 32 pairs of iron columns, each 80 feet tall, and this giant iron circular system had been lifted by hydraulics, so it was really cutting edge at the time. In fact, one of the sources I looked at in preparation for today's discussion were some of the preparation materials that the Americans had put together, because they were going to have the next World's Fair. The next World's Fair was going to be held in Philadelphia in 1876 to mark the 100th anniversary of the establishment of the United States. And they sent a number of commissioners and had a number of reports out about the Habsburgs World's Fair in 1873. And let me just read you a couple parts of the report that the Philadelphia Exposition Committee wrote about this World's Fair in preparation as they were thinking about how to build their own. Quote, no description can give an idea of the size and beauty of the industrial palace with its magnificent dome, the largest ever constructed, and its elaborately ornamented facades and portals, unquote. And then if you go through, they talk about how much space is taken up. They talk about how the cost was, all kinds of things. I mean, these are interesting documents that you can access through the database that we'll have on the website, where you can see in English language a lot of the reports and discussions and firsthand accounts of these commissioners sent by the Americans to Vienna to study this exhibition and learn from it. Good and learn from bad. Apparently, the American minister plenipotentiary in Vienna was very helpful in all of this. This was John Jay II, the grandson, by the way, of the great Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, John Jay. This John Jay was a famous abolitionist, anti-slavery activist who President Grant sent to Vienna to represent the United States at this time period. And he helped the commissioners as they were working on their plans for the World's Expo of 1876, which, by the way, Elizabeth Boone talks about in her book that I mentioned earlier, to give that another plug. From a historical or historian's point of view, it's also interesting that John Jay, the minister, the American minister in Vienna, who helped with all of this from the perspective of the United States, later became the sixth president of the American Historical Association, right? The main professional organization of historians in the United States. The American report goes on to say, quote, the cost and extent of the Vienna buildings are given with a view rather to avoid than to emulate them, either in magnificence or outlay. And while we should endeavor to celebrate our nation's centennial in a manner worthy of our nation's dignity, it is not necessary in order to do so that we should attempt to imitate the grandeur and dazzling beauty of the expositions of the old world, but rather desire to appear for what we really are, a plain, practical, and common sense people. The cost of our buildings should be kept within the lowest possible sum consistent with ample space, as they are only of a temporary character. It is useless for us to attempt competition with the old world in external architectural effect. Rather, should we look to the beauty and convenience of the interior arrangements of the building. Unquote. This gives you a sense from the American perspective what they saw in Vienna. Vienna itself, actually, though, as a World's Fair, was considered a bit of a bust. If you read the original accounts at the beginning, the opening in May and June, apparently almost nobody went out there. Nobody took those horse-drawn trams out from the downtown out to the city because the weather was so bad. Also, they weren't done yet. They weren't even finished with a lot of it. The reports go that when the emperor and the other dignitaries met had the opening in May, the traffic jam reached all the way from the fairgrounds back into the city, over a mile and a half. The place was still under construction. The rain also kept people away. And if that weren't enough, not very long after the opening of the exhibition, there was a stock market crash. The exhibition opens on May 1st, and on May 9th, we have Black Friday on the Vienna Stock Exchange. 110 bankruptcies declared. They had to call the police in to stop the rioting or the disruptions associated with the banking collapse. That shows on a number of different levels the problems associated with the exhibition. It never earned the money back that it was put into it. It did have a large number of visitors. Millions of people visited it. Some of the days, the Philadelphia commissioners report they could have 100,000 to 179,000 people a day at it later on. It really got going. Eventually, it had 7.3 million visitors, and it also had 16 different associated congresses and conferences and meetings and all these medals and prizes and citations awarded, tens of thousands. And there was also, you know, some scientific activity associated with it. There were some possibilities of learning stuff and advancing stuff. The great Belgian inventor Zenobe Graham, for example, apparently was fiddling around with his dynamo there and came up with the first ever industrial electric motor, which is considered now to be the basis of all direct electric motors to come. And for those of you who know about the Austro-Hungarian inventor Nikola Tesla apparently saw a version of this a couple years later when he was studying in Graz, where he studied at the university. This great electric motor of Zenobe Graham was on display at this World's Fair. So there were positives coming out of this. It did bring millions of people together, awarded tens of thousands of prizes, got the word out. But on the other hand, there were economic problems. It never made the money back. They built something like 10 new luxury hotels in the city to try to take advantage of the tourists, and the tourists didn't come. In addition to the crash on Black Friday of the Vienna Stock Exchange, that summer, and this should sound, I guess, unfortunately familiar, an epidemic hit the city. Not COVID, but cholera. In August of 1873, cholera hits the city and thousands of people die. Hardly the best advertising opportunity for Vienna or to bring large numbers of people to the city. So I think if we look back on this World's Fair, we have to say that it had mixed results. It was an opportunity for the Habsburgs to present themselves and their newly revised Austro-Hungarian Empire in a different light, to show that the emperor, and particularly his brothers, the various archdukes involved with the organization of this, were progressive, tied to things like electricity and hydraulics and construction, lots of machinery. All of this was a positive, but and then also, I guess I would say, before I finish the thought, the effects on the city, the development of the infrastructure, the creation of this modern city has to be partly related to the World's Fair. But the result wasn't as great as people had hoped. You know, the Habsburgs were able to maybe partly rebrand themselves, but the Habsburgs Austro-Hungarian Empire also showed that it really wasn't able to succeed at the scale that they had hoped. They built the largest rotunda in the world, but underneath that rotunda, the backstory was that they didn't totally succeed financially. And going down in history, this World's Fair is not as well known as many others. So with that, I think I'll draw to an end my presentation for today. If you have any questions, always feel free to contact us at the Wirth Institute. As I said, go to the website. You'll see more information. That's where you'll get the visual images of this exhibition. And then I'll prepare over the next few days while you are listening to this. I'll be a step ahead of you, putting my notes together and thinking about my next podcast, which will take us behind the scenes and introduce us to the von Trapp family before Maria arrived. See you then. Have a nice week. Bye.